This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
Uber wants to beat Amazon of retail, of e-commerce.
The Disney Plus service might actually end up benefiting Netflix.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
Capital return is the key story for the U.S. banks.
The telcos naturally are moving into content distribution. I think it's a good move.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we are going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
And today, we're going to take a look at inaction and ambition, oil and gas.
Plus, big bank balance sheet strengthening amid virus risks.
But we want to begin with our first guest who writes that SpaceX Starlink shadow is looming over the global telecom industry, from where we welcome Bloomberg Intelligence senior industry analyst Matthew Bloxham. Yes, we get to talk about space.
There you go.
Forget this week. This week didn't happen. Let's talk about space. Okay, so what's your thesis?
So, you know, I mean, we've had a number of satellite companies, you know, get into operation, talk about ground plans, but a lot of them have kind of really fallen flat on their feet. We've had quite high-profile bankruptcy this year in OneWeb. And then we've got, you know, Elon Musk setting this huge vision and actually getting on and doing it. So, you know, we had this quite big event about a week ago where they announced pricing for their public beta of this Starlink service, which is offering about 100 meg of internet bandwidth at respectful latency. So it's kind of like using your mobile phone for connectivity. So it's a decent service. And it's actually working, and it's actually in the hands of people in the U.S. Now, it's going to be a few years before this is a globally available product, but you know, it's a really important first step, and people seem to be liking the beta service that they've been given.
So, Matt, so SpaceX, we're talking Elon Musk here, so it's always big, it's always you know, high profile. Just explain to us what Starlink is and what Mr. Musk proposes it could eventually become.
Yeah, so Starlink is planned eventually to be a network of anywhere between 12,000 and 42,000 satellites, essentially providing blanket coverage of the world and giving everybody a kind of a decent internet service. And it's initially focused on people that today can't even get internet at all, or if they can get it, it's really very slow. And yeah, they're still very much at the early stage of that. They've got about 1,000 satellites up in orbit now. I think that the big difference compared to other satellite carriers that already exist, people like Inmarsat, is this operates at what's called low Earth orbit, so about 500 kilometers above the Earth rather than, you know, several thousand kilometers above the Earth, which is where lots of traditional satellites sit. And that the important difference there is in what's called latency, which is the kind of delay that you sometimes get when you're surfing the internet. You click and then you have to wait. And that's really important for things like video conferencing, gaming, and just kind of general good use of the internet, a fully functioning internet service. So that's kind of quite a big technology leap. And they've got all sorts of other kind of new technology in the satellites. The satellites themselves are really small. They're about the size of a table. They're quite cheap to produce, and they're going to deploy lasers between them, so they don't actually have to communicate with ground stations, which is another kind of historic technology problem for the satellite operators. So you're going to have this essentially this kind of internet that's just working completely in space without having to rely too much on ground connectivity. So kind of quite a lot of technology leapfrogs they're making with this innovation.
Okay, so let me just dumb this down for myself a little bit. So there's going to be like tens of these guys just like in space that talk to each other via laser, not any ground control, but they're not like in space, they're like somewhere in between.
That's right, yeah, it's kind of just the kind of lowest they can really be and still be in orbit.
Who controls that, like the airwaves, like who owns that?
Well, there's a lot of bandwidth there, and I mean, it's still controlled by national government. So they've had to get approval for from the FCC, the telecom regulator in the US, to be able to use those frequencies in the US. And they'll have to go around and get approval country by country to operate this. So, you know, that's going to kind of take them a bit of time, because you have to kind of submit all sorts of applications before you're approved. But I think, you know, getting the US approvals, which they've got, and actually demonstrating that the service works in the US is a massive step forward and a great platform to take that to other countries in Europe and Africa and Asia, and to kind of get a relatively speedy approval for the service.
So, Matt, where are we in the time frame here? You mentioned that, I guess, they're testing here in the US. What's the time frame for getting a Trubel global service rolled out?
So, yeah, they're just short of 1,000 satellites today, and they've said in the past that they can operate a kind of initial global service with about 1,600 satellites. Now, they put up about 60 satellites with each launch, and they're doing about 2 launches a month at the moment. So on that run rate, they'll kind of be there sometime in the first half of next year. So I think, you know, give them a few months to kind of iron out any wrinkles with this public beta service, and you could see them launch commercial service maybe in the first half of next year in the US and Canada. And they've already said that they're kind of working with certain European countries to get regulatory approval there.
Amazing. This was like the perfect way to start off this hour. Thank you so much, Senior Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Industry Analyst Matthew Bloxham.
Coming up on the program, a look at oil and gas companies transitioning to low carbon.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies in 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BIGO on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, our next guest points out that half of the oil and gas companies are taking action when it comes to CO2 emissions, and half are not. Joining us to break down what's going on is Bloomberg Intelligence Senior ESG Analyst Eric Kane. Eric, thanks so much for joining us here. So we know that the energy industry overall is trying to move to a cleaner footprint, if you will. Give us a sense of how well they're doing.
Sure, it's a great question. What we see ultimately is in the peer set of about 39 companies that we looked at across integrated oils, refining and marketing, and also exploration and production, that more than half have announced greenhouse gas reduction targets. However, when we analyze those targets, forecast them out to the future to see where these companies will be, assuming they're successful in achieving those targets, we actually see that the majority of them fall short of the International Energy Agency's target, which is aligned with a 2-degree scenario. So although we see a kind of growing ambition, we do believe it falls short of what is needed to limit warming.
That in no way does that surprise me in terms of U.S. companies being very far behind when it comes to taking action on this. What are they doing that's right? Like specifically, is it carbon capture? Is it less flaring? Is it finding a way to get methane emissions out of the air? And where are they just not thinking big enough? And I'm thinking specifically maybe like scope 3 emissions, which is taking into account emissions from the products that you sell.
Right. You raised a lot of great points there. Certainly one of the key observations that we've made is that the U.S. companies are really lagging behind the European peers, for example. When we do look at those companies, primarily the European integrateds that have the most ambitious targets, we are seeing a variety of different strategies. I think you touched on a lot of the key components. So we know that they're increasingly going to rely on carbon capture, use and storage. They're also shifting their business models to some degree. So they're planning to reduce the amount of oil and gas that they ultimately produce and transition to renewable energy, for example. So it does seem like there are kind of multiple angles that the companies are taking, and no strategy is identical to another. And then with respect to scope 3, I think that really is, you know, what we consider to be the elephant in the room. When we look at your average oil and gas company, scope 3 emissions account for about 85% of their total emissions, which is obviously very significant. And we really only see a handful of companies even disclosing their Scope 3 emissions, let alone setting targets that include their Scope 3 emissions. Again, the European integrateds are really leading in both areas. They're disclosing that information, and more we're seeing that they're setting targets that also include their Scope 3 emissions, which suggests really that they're moving away from oil and towards cleaner types of energy.
So, Eric, for the ones, for the companies that are noticeably lagging behind where they need to be, what can be done? Is it, and who does it? Is it some agency can find them? Is it a global agency? How do you bring some of these actors more into line?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I would say there are a number of levers out there that we're seeing. But unfortunately, you know, perhaps not enough to cause companies like Exxon or Chevron to really act. So some of those levers, we see the formation of a group called the Climate Action 100 Plus, which is a group of investors that has more than 500 investors and over $47 trillion in assets under management. And essentially, the signatories to this investor group have essentially acknowledge that they believe that it's their fiduciary duty to try to get the world's top greenhouse gas emissions emitting companies to reduce their emissions and to strengthen climate-related disclosures and to improve governance of that issue. So I think that's one area. We also see, obviously, you know, kind of continuing shareholder action against companies through shareholder proposals. And then I think, you know, one of the things that we expect to see going forward is, you know, this idea of maybe stranded assets really kind of taking shape. And when we think about what that means, we know, of course, that oil and gas companies are largely valued on the oil and gas assets they have that are yet to be produced. If we start looking at scenarios where maybe there's a $40 per ton of carbon cost associated with that, well, then all of a sudden, you know, the economics of producing some of that oil change. So we really think, you know, it will most likely be a combination of these factors that will ultimately, you know, push those who aren't acting to act at some point in the future.
I kind of scoffed in my skeptical way. So something that I think is interesting when it comes to, say, the European guys is that they have an infrastructure already set up because they're a diversified international oil company. So their argument is that they can pull those different levers of their different businesses to then capitalize on things like wind distribution or EV battery charging, etc., as they become this like weird utility company. But the oil industry here in the U.S., with the exception of Chevron and Exxon, they don't really have that. So I wonder, like, what's the case? Like, what's the economic case?
Yeah, it's a great question, and really I think Exxon and Chevron do have that ability, so it continues to be you know, kind of a major omission from an ESG standpoint that they are yet to kind of address this issue on a strategic basis. And we recently saw kind of BlackRock even voting against directors because they didn't think Exxon was taking you know, this issue seriously enough. So with respect to the other U.S. companies, I think you're right. They do have less of an integrated business, less of a diversified business, so their opportunities are perhaps slimmer in terms of entering new businesses. But what we do see is there are significant opportunities for emissions reductions nonetheless. So if we look at E&P, for example, one of the larger sources of emissions would be from methane emissions, and we know that that's a considerable issue. So what we would hope to see is that companies at least come out with strategies to reduce their operational emissions and to try to limit that as much as possible.
Eric, are there any U.S. companies that are actually doing a good job, and what are they doing right?
It's a great question, and we really don't see a lot of U.S. companies kind of in our group of leaders, if you will.
Our thanks to Bloomberg Intelligence senior ESG analyst Eric Kane.
And coming up on the program, why big bank balance sheets are strengthening during the global coronavirus outbreak.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. It's 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analysts covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide.
After a 2020 jump, much lower bank loss provisions are expected in 2021 through 2022 to help us understand why. In the middle of this virus uncertainty, let's bring in Bloomberg Intelligence senior industry analyst Allison Williams. I mean, I get the idea. So, like, it was really bad earlier in the year. They put a lot of money to deal with bad loans. That didn't happen. They released some of it. But come on. Are we in rolling lockdown land? There's no vaccine.
Well, I think the real difference this time, and you know, I hate even saying those words, but there is a difference in the accounting this time, and I think that's really the driver in terms of why we saw such huge provisions in the first half, even though we really haven't seen the losses start to come through yet. So the accounting change basically dictates that the banks look out over the life of the loans and say what they estimate those losses are. And so the big provisions we saw in the first half were a combination of, you know, economic expectations, not just for today, but over the next couple of years and how those play out, and the ultimate losses on the portfolio, not the losses that they've seen yet. So we really have not started to see losses come through yet. We did see a little bit this quarter, but in fact, what the banks are saying is we're not going to see a big jump in the actual losses until the second half of next year. And that really relates to the fact that credit card is going to be one of the big areas that we see losses. And the timing of, you know, the forbearance coming off, the help coming off to those accounts, and then the way that accounting is done in terms of 180 days being delinquent, being written off, we're not going to see that until next year. So the losses are still coming. And then the key variable will be, do the economic projections change, right? So today there's a base case scenario, based on what the expectations are for the economy. The banks, looking at banks like J.P. Morgan and Bank of America that I follow, incorporate some downside to the base case scenario as they look out. But if the assumptions, you know, basically come in line, they're saying we could be past the peak in provisions.
That's very, very interesting, because it just has me think about some of the pandemic news headlines that are coming across right now with, you know, various European countries shutting down to various degrees. Talk about that perhaps here in the U.S. to some extent, to the extent cases continue to rise. Do you think the banks have kind of the second wave built into that forecast, Allison? And as they think about their 2021 outlook, they feel like even if that occurs, we can deal with it?
I think so much of it obviously is sort of guesstimates at this point. Right. So if we get the second wave, things do take a turn for the worse. And then what happens along the lines of stimulus, obviously, because that's really been a huge factor for the banks so far. But if you look at the provisions that they set up, again, they're looking at the life of the loans. Someone like J.P. Morgan and Bank of America, they've already reserved for basically half of the loss rate that they saw or were tested in the Federal Reserve severely adverse stress case scenario. So basically, you know, looking at the loss rates that the Fed assumes in sort of the worst case scenario in their stress test, the banks have already reserved for basically half that amount, again, over the life of the loan. So we haven't seen the losses yet. So that being said, it is half that amount, and could we envision a scenario where things are potentially worse than the stress test? There were added COVID layers that dictated that we could see worse. So it really will depend on how things go from here, obviously. If things worsen much more than the banks expect, you could actually see some change to reserves based on that. So in the first quarter to the second quarter, that was a lot of the sort of bulk of that provision add was sort of the worsening expectations. This past quarter, what we saw was really lesser loan growth. And so as you saw some of those commercial loans being paid down, a lot of the positive surprise, if you will, to the earnings and the provisions was really just lesser loans.
All right, Allison, thank you for the conversation. Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Industry Analyst Allison Williams.
Coming up on the program, U.S. voters' choices are igniting an advancing marijuana sales boom.
In Jersey. Go, yeah, Paul. You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, U.S. voters approved five state ballot initiatives to legalize marijuana. That's good news for national legal marijuana sales. For more, we want to welcome Bloomberg Intelligence senior industry analyst Ken Shea. What are the states?
Hi, Alex. The state legalization ballots in New Jersey, Arizona, Montana, and South Dakota is significant, not only because we have now 15 states that have legalized recreational use markets, but that significant revenues are going to be added to this industry to the tune of about 5% in 2020 and is potentially 10% in 2025. So it's significant.
So, Ken, what do we know about the weed market in some of the more developed markets like Colorado? How big is it? How fast is it growing? Does it contribute meaningful taxes to the state?
So in Colorado, one of the early adopters of legal marijuana really opened the doors for many other states to enter, because what they demonstrated was not only are they satisfying their constituency, you know, the public who wants this product, but they're doing it in a responsible way that keeps the federal government, you know, away from, you know, closing it down. And they're generating pretty consistently rising tax revenues. So other cash-starved states, particularly in the era of COVID here, are looking to do the same.
Yeah, it seems to make perfect sense in some ways. But one of the big issues, of course, is that states versus federal, because it's not legal on a federal level. Have we found, are the workarounds already there? Are the companies able to manage it?
Yeah, I think they have. I mean, first of all, the overwhelming 5x5 clean sweep signals that You know, Americans want full legalization. You know, 2/3 of Americans already support this. At some point, you would think the federal government would abide by, you know, the public's demands. The revenues for this industry are already approaching $19 billion, almost the scale of bottled water. It's no longer a nascent, upcoming industry. It's already at a size where it's a legitimate consumer products segment. And so at some point, if and when it does get federally legalized, you would think the consumer products companies will get more involved. But even before that time, we think more states are going to legalize. You know, this is just a success begets success. You know, as other states see the benefits of legalizing, more states will follow suit.
Hey, Ken, I'm a Jersey guy. Am I going to start seeing, like, fields of marijuana in the swamps of Jersey here? How's this going to play out?
So in New Jersey, you know, probably the biggest prize in terms of legalization, we see that sales could approach $1 billion by the year 2022. And so it's a large populous state. It's a state that's been trying to legalize for a while. There's only 12 legal dispensaries in the entire state. And we think there's going to be a very significant growth trajectory in that. So consumers will get greater access to legal marijuana. There'll be proliferation in the products. It won't just be, you know, rolled flour and oils. We're going to see consumer products like, you know, beverage and edible infused cannabis products, and so on. So you're going to see easier access and a broader base of users in New Jersey.
What companies are going to benefit the most?
So in New Jersey, companies like Curaleaf and Acreage Holdings, they are among the largest of the so-called multi-state operators. But I think what New Jersey will try to do, and many states will follow suit, is try to be more equitable from a social point of view. They don't want it just to be a business that is a big winner among all the big national companies. They want to make a way for some, local companies, some smaller companies, to participate in the growth as well.
And Ken, what I just recently learned is, you think about it, you can't truck this stuff across interstate lines and all that kind of stuff. So whatever state legalizes it, you got to grow it in that mm-hmm. state, right? So again, you have to grow it in New Jersey if you want to sell it in New Jersey. Is that right?
That's right, Paul. New Jersey is one of the many states in which they require vertical integration, meaning if you've got to sell it, you have to grow your own. That's the part of the quality control aspects of the business. And so it can be capital intensive because it ties up capital. But on the other hand, it creates an opportunity for some other firms, such as real estate companies, that will do sale-leasebacks for these companies. So it frees up their cash, and so these real estate companies are taking advantage of that vertical integration requirement.
What are some of the stocks out there, and how have they performed?
So the biggest companies that people know are Tilray and Canopy Growth and Acreage Holdings. Those are Canadian-based companies. They haven't performed that well because largely they're shut out from getting into the U.S. because they would jeopardize their stock listings, who don't allow companies to participate directly in a federally illegal business. But the companies that would fare the best, I would say, right now would be the multi-state operators. Again, it's Curaleaf, it's Trulieve, it's Acreage Holdings. But then you also have a group of companies that don't compete directly in the business, but they sell the picks and axes, the so-called ancillary companies. These are companies like Scotts Miracle-Gro and Grow Generation. They sell the organic nutrients, soils, some of their lighting equipment to both commercial and home growers. And as I mentioned, some real estate companies who are doing sale leasebacks to these vertical integrated companies are doing well, doing that as well.
Ken, thanks so much. Really appreciate your time. Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Industry Analyst Ken Shea.
All right, let's switch gears now to Netflix. The company could have even a stronger credit profile than its competitors. Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Credit Analyst Steve Flynn joins us to break it down. Steve, when people think about Netflix and as a company, they think about the stock and how it just kind of goes to the moon and then some. Talk to us about the credit profile for Netflix.
Sure, Paul. So Netflix's credit profile has changed significantly over the past year. The company had incurred significant free cash flow deficits over the past several years as it invested tons of money into content. And therefore, even though they had the high growth, which the equity market obviously preferred that you referenced earlier, it did cost the company a lot of money. And the company had to hit the high-yield bond market on numerous occasions to raise cash to fund the deficits. Yet things have switched this year. So Netflix is experiencing a $5 billion free cash flow swing from a deficit of more than $3 billion in 2019 to positive free cash flow in the $2 billion area for 2020. And the big driver here is not only higher subscribers, higher revenue, higher EBITDA, but also a slowdown in spending on content as social distancing around the globe has led to a slowdown in the production of content.
Well, so I was going to say, is that sustainable?
No. Well, Netflix expects content to increase next year, and the company is forecasting a free cash flow deficit for 2021 of up to $1 billion. Now, I think that is too conservative. Under our models, we see Netflix producing positive free cash flow of $500 million or more, and we think the company is establishing a sustained free cash flow credit profile, which is something that the rating agencies are looking for.
Yeah, we know when Netflix first hit the market, I was shocked at how much they were able to borrow and what I considered low rates, given the fact that they didn't have any free cash flow and they were just burning through it. But I guess credit investors, Steve, were able to look far enough in advance and see this thing turning free cash flow positive. How have the bonds traded?
Yes, the bonds trade very well for high yield. So the bonds trade at yields of about 3% or less. And you may ask, well, that's, you know, very low for high yield. And I say, you know, it is too low for high yield. Yet I think we have to start thinking about Netflix as an investment grade credit profile. And I think it's just a matter of time before the rating agencies will catch up with the credit profile. So if we think about Netflix, you know, this year it'll have a net leverage ratio of only about 1.5 times, a free cash flow to debt ratio of about 13%, and a liquidity war chest in the neighborhood of $9 billion. If that doesn't, you know, resemble an investment-grade credit profile in the media sector, I don't know what does.
So why isn't it then investment-grade? Like, I mean, because you can make the argument with what is investment-grade, it gets access to so many other indices that then a lot of credit investors are going to have to buy.
Yes. I think the big issue is the establishment of sustained positive free cash flow. So the company cautiously has said that's going to be, you know, a couple of years away, and then, you know, cash flow is much higher than anticipated in 2020. And I think they are being conservative with calling for a potential deficit in 2021. But as we get through 2021 and we start to produce quarterly cash flow that's better than anticipated, I think there's a chance that the company will have established sustained positive free cash flow, and that will be viewed positively by the rating agencies.
And one of the things that concerns investors, I suspect is a bigger concern for credit investors, is the investment they make every single year in programming. I mean, it's like, you know, it's $18 billion, $20 billion a year and just growing like crazy. To what extent are the credit markets kind of concerned about that kind of spending?
Yeah, well, as long as the spending is, you know, fueling investments of fueling future free cash flow growth, right? So the high yield markets for many, many years, as you know, was willing to spend on companies that invest in assets that have future free cash flow generation. So the high yield market is comfortable companies that may be burning cash flow now, as long as they see future free cash flow production, they can easily get comfortable with that. And they have done that with Netflix.
What about Netflix's competitors?
Yeah, so Netflix has deep-pocketed competitors, no doubt about that, right? Whether it's Amazon Prime, Hulu, you know, AT&T products, Disney products, etc. Netflix does have a lot of competition, but that hasn't slowed their investment profile, and I'd argue that they're, you know, have a lot more to spend than even some of their, you know, companies that are larger overall media companies.
All right, good to talk to you. Thank you so very much. Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Credit Analyst Stephen Flynn.
That's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.